Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So one of the issues, Sam, that we've been talking and thinking about throughout, it's always creeping into our conversations, is journalism itself and the news media. One of the questions I often get in my talks is, where can we look for good journalism these days? Who's producing good, hard-hitting work about politics in ways that reach new audiences and that make fresh claims? And every now and then, we find new voices that enter into this media fray and really touch a nerve. And nothing has triggered this conversation more, obviously, than our current president and his chronic attacks on the rigged media and the biased media. In addition to kind of searching for new voices who can speak and write in an effective way in the middle of this tumultuous presidency, new technology is also constantly changing the media world, and everyone's trying to figure out how exactly we produce the news and how we should go about telling our stories. So today we have with us an exciting guest, Lauren Duca, an award-winning journalist and editor at Teen Vogue, where she writes the Thigh High Politics column. She's a regular also on CNN, MSNBC, and has written for other outlets, including New York Magazine, The Nation, and The New Yorker. She was named by Adweek as one of the 15 political power players. And even cooler, she was named by Brooklyn Magazine as one of the 100 culture influencers. She was front and center around the time of Donald Trump's election with her piece, Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, which went viral and generated a lot of important conversation about what this candidate and what this presidency would mean for the nation. Welcome to our show, Lauren.
Hi, thank you for that incredible introduction.
Well, it really is fantastic to have you here. And before the show, I told Sam I was just reading over some of your articles again and what you've been writing recently. And it really is just terrific to see your perspectives on what's going on in the world of politics. And it's nice to see the kind of reach that you've had. I heard you told a great story. I believe it was in your commencement address. Now I'm trying to remember where you were telling it about during the campaign.
Let's hear about where was the commencement address?
Oh, okay. Yeah, the commencement was at Bard College at Simon's Rock, which is a very cool place that it's an early college. So it's literally a bunch of high school dropouts turning into college graduates, yeah, which is...
They go when they're 12.
Yeah. Right. I don't know if it's quite 12, but they do go there earlier than usual.
Right. So you're really taking the teen part of Teen Vogue pretty seriously there.
Literally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. Old audience.
So you talk a little bit about, so you wrote this article I mentioned on Donald Trump gaslighting America. Maybe for those of our listeners who haven't read it, you could just summarize what it was about. But then you talk about some of the reaction to it, which I thought was really interesting, including a conversation you had in the CNN green room. So maybe you could refresh us both on the article and what happened in that green room.
Sure. So the article, you know, I think that the reason why it resonated is not necessarily because it was making a new claim, but because it was consolidating something that a lot of people were feeling, wondering why they were being made to doubt their own memories and being able to kind of apply a label to that and empower people to discuss the just mass deception that was happening during the campaign and continues to happen. So gaslighting is a form of psychological abuse in which the victim is made to feel crazy. And in this case, the victim is America. And it's sort of unpacking the way in which the conversation was routinely being scrambled, either just through contradictions or lying or any sort of rejection of fact-based narratives that we saw and continue to see. And then the reaction was very patronizing and The story that you're referring to is in the CNN green room. Before I was about to discuss the piece with Don Lemon, Carl Bernstein was there to talk about safe spaces with two other old white men. So that was why he was present. And he looked me up and down and said, "You don't look like a teen." Like, this was his reaction. It was just very, like, the very literal old guard of journalism sort of asking if I was literally a teenage girl was sort of encapsulates the reaction that I got from a number of different sources.
Now, is the idea there that, but that's a little bit different from telling a lie to your face. So was he just trying to act like you had nothing to say because of how you looked? What was going on there?
I think that anybody, as I said in my commencement speech, I just think that anybody under the age of 73 probably looks like a teen to Carl Bernstein. So I don't know. It's just, there was a lot of, to be serious, there was a lot of sort of stealthy condescension coming from established figures in mainstream media where, you know, it was positioning the piece and Teen Vogue like it was some crazy, radical, you know, unique event that right. happened in a vacuum. It just refused to acknowledge. I think it was really stinking of the way that we reject teen girls, young women from political conversation. And, you know, what exactly are we requiring of the people that that are the voices that become political writers?
Yeah.
And that often having background in writing about pop culture or beauty or fashion or whatever it is actually used to discount women. It's interesting because sports journalism kind of flows directly into political writing sometimes, and yet the gendered alternative actually is an obstacle.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit. So if you look around green rooms and if you look around who gets on TV, as you point out, it tilts white, it tilts male. People can get into their 70s and 80s and be considered respectable figures in that domain. So I just want to rewind a little bit and point out to listeners that your article about gaslighting America was written in December. So it was a month after the election. People were still in some fair amount of shock over this very unexpected outcome. And this idea of telling people things that are false to their face and pretending that it's true, that hits an emotional truth that it feels like a lot of commentators were just somehow mentally unprepared for. So here's an example in this week's news. The idea that Trey Gowdy, the chair of an investigatory committee in the House of Representatives, said that it's routine for Russia to be in contact with national campaigns. Okay, so my reaction to that is, wait, it's routine for Russia to be in contact. Sure, Russia was visiting my class the other day, also routine. And so this idea of saying things that are plainly false, by the way, there were no Russians visiting my class last week, but saying things that are plainly false and pretending that they're true, right? You said that back in December, and I am fascinated by the fact that you put your finger on that, and I think you weren't the only one, but just the idea that that was something that was somehow missed by conventional political commentators. So how does that fit with what you've noticed in green rooms and you know, dealing with popular figures such as, say, Tucker Carlson?
Well, I think that it's not only was that part of Donald Trump's strategy, but there's such an amazingly aggressive effort to normalize everything that he does. I mean, there's incredible journalism coming out of the New York Times and the Washington Post, but even the New York Times is running articles like, say a nice thing about Donald Trump. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yes. That was right before FBI Director Comey got fired. And, you know, I don't remember seeing did the piece come out?
Oh, I don't know.
Did they have a column about nice things said about Trump? Because I somehow, that didn't happen.
I mean, well, and it's like even they would excuse, like, so when he would lie, I mean, do you remember that there was a whole semantic debate over should we use the word lying? And right. And it's just, it's absolutely absurd. I mean, I think that the problem is tenfold because it's not just that Donald Trump is doing these things. It's that the media is tripping over themselves to, you know, perform neutrality and perform objectivity, and and they're not calling out bullshit. And I think that it's, you know, there's all these little examples of like, well, did he really mock a disabled reporter, or was, you know, it's just like, what was he exactly doing in that moment? And it's all of this nitpicky nonsense where, you know, increasingly the political norms protecting democracy are being just decimated, and where kind of apologizing to Jeffrey Lord for saying for Anderson Cooper's having to apologize to Jeffrey Lord and Kellyanne Conway, and we're kind of, that's sort of like, to me, the ultimate example of the way that the mainstream media is failing to fulfill its role of keeping a check on this power, and instead is kind of working to normalize it in like very trivializing semantic ways that are letting a lot of toxic stuff seep through.
Do you think there's been any change? I mean, you wrote this article when this was getting started, and I remember it was a moment when a lot of people in the media didn't exactly know how to describe or talk about the way that Donald Trump handled himself or his surrogates on television. You triggered this conversation where you were just very direct in what's going on. Do you not think there's been any changes since he became president? Are we pretty much where we are during the campaign, or has some of the media evolved a little more?
There have been, you know, we have the fact-checking cryons and whatever. I think that there is, it's not quite as bad as it was, but I think that the thing is that the system of the old voices is kind of let him through, and it's clearly not able to, it's not as powerful a check as I think we thought it was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the weakness comes, so like a lot of the power of Teen Vogue and a lot of the power that I have in my voice, one, I don't have to worry about access, so I admit that that's part of it.
So not having access helps. So do original report. You don't do original reportage. You do commentary and opinion, or do you regard, like, where do you put yourself on the spectrum between reportage and opinion?
Yeah, my columns are op-eds, but okay. I hold them to a journalistic standard, but I also do reported work. Like, I'm right now working on a piece that's more cultural, actually. Thank God. It's really nice. It's good for my heart, but it's just talking to the fashion industry about how they perceive fashion as political and how can activism be commodified. So I'm doing some softer reporting. I'm definitely not going to, you know, release his tax returns as many a postcard to Teen Vogue has asked me to do. But I think that, so the thing is with Teen Vogue is we're starting from a position of supporting human rights. That's just like where the process is beginning. We're not showing our work for saying climate change exists. And I think that often things that are kind of positioned as advocacy journalism are just the truth. And it's very scary how I have seen that shift in small degrees, actually, I think even since the gaslighting piece. So while there is like a more surface level recognition of, oh, he's literally lying, I think that they're the things that we're willing to call out and the concessions that are being made and the space being given to alternative facts is kind of astounding. And, you know, the New York Times hiring a climate change denier is not the least among them.
Could I ask to kind of shift a little bit? So when did you start writing your column, and how did you get involved with Teen Vogue? I'm curious about how this platform evolved.
Yeah, I started writing the column in February, at the end of February, but I was working for them for much longer. I started in January of 2016 as their weekend editor, which is, it's funny because people were like, oh, maybe they'll hire you full time right now. But I've always had a great relationship with them. I wanted to be able to do my own thing freelancing during the week. I came from HuffPost, so being on staff is just not something I ever want to do again. And so it was a really good situation with them. It's very much a news judgment position where I had to be, you know, whatever the politics story was of the weekend, right next to Selena Gomez having a new Pantene, that was all, it ran the gamut. So it was a cool sort of like overviewing the culture kind of was the way I was spending my weekends. And I wrote the Donald Trump is Gaslighting America was actually a part of a book proposal because I just needed to be working around this kind of toxic culture moment. And I wanted to find a consistent way to do that. And then that was the sample chapter. And this, when the CIA contradictions broke, that was sort of the clearest, okay, he's contradicting a fact-based narrative. There's no argument. Like, the Hollywood Access tapes get into some nuance, and there's some arguments about what exactly is happening there because we're all insane. But with the CIA thing, it was pretty clear-cut. And it, so it seemed like we fit it to that story. And then I guess,
when did you realize that Teen Vogue could offer a really good and original platform for covering politics and covering it in ways different than what you'll see in the Times or watch on CNN? Was it your editor? Did you kind of see this space that existed?
Yeah, well, it was very organic because Teen Vogue has always taken young women seriously. It was always just, we were covering things very frankly. I knew going into it that I would be able to be doing some like elevated cultural commentary. And then, you know, as I was working for over a year on the weekends, we were covering very, you know, police brutality or the nightclub shooting at Pulse. I remember very well. I mean, that was covered with the same rigor as it would have been a breaking news desk in any newsroom. And, you know, as the election ramped up, it fit naturally in. Now that I've had a chance to think about it and what writing for Teen Vogue affords, I think that it makes things more accessible and it breaks them down. And I don't think it dumbs them down. I think that, honestly, it's not just young women who are hoping for that. It's everyone. I mean, I constantly get these emails, you know, I'm Gary, I'm 42, I can't believe I'm reading Teen Vogue. And it's like, calm down, Gary. But like everyone.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, but that, there's a certain asymmetry there, right? Because, for instance, let's say if a woman reads a column by somebody in GQ about politics, that somehow doesn't attract comment. But for 42-year-old Gary to be opening up Teen Vogue, which, you know, it's got a certain, you know, you pause a little bit. So let me back out a little bit and say, I want to ask you about ways in which, in some ways, what you're doing viewed the right way is not remarkable. And what I mean by that is there are other magazines that combine culture, fashion, and politics. If I think about Charles Pierce at Vanity Fair, Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone, if I think about the writers at GQ, there are people who did that. Now, you know, several of those are thought of as male-oriented magazines. And one thing that strikes me in this year's post-Trump environment is that a sector of women who were previously not very engaged in politics have become engaged. And so what I see here is these kind of male-ish magazines, male journalists, you come along with your thigh-high politics column and Teen Vogue. So where do you position yourself in terms of being new versus not new? Since you yourself are new at political writing, and yet there are precedents for this.
I wanted to say one more thing about the power that I feel like I have a Teen Vogue, which fits into this, is that I don't think a lot of political writing is accessible to anyone who is not like a highly specialized lawyer. I mean, there's just a lot of
because
writing.
It gets into reconciliation or something like that. Is that the reason?
I mean, it just, especially the highly complex stories that are coming out of this administration, where it's just you like there's an increased importance on this translator role of like, not just the op-ed columnist, but a person who can be trusted to unpack and untangle when, I mean, we could give spark notes for what's happening with Russia. It would take 45 minutes to like effectively even just give a surface layer understanding of that like lasagna of things that is happening. And I just think that, you know, there's a lot of people who don't feel comfortable discussing politics because they're worried that they don't understand, and maybe they don't because it's so alienating. And also just like a lot of political writers are writing for other political writers, you know, and missing the public and not empowering people with information. And I think that that is very much what Teen Vogue is doing. I mean, obviously there's been websites that have culture and politics. I think of us as not radical in the sense that I hate that I'm, you know, the things I'm doing, the things Teen Vogue are doing should be the standard. And it's super unfortunate that they're seen as so special and unique. And I feel like I'm treated as though I'm a little more radical every day, which is frightening. And the things that we're willing to say and to have the bravery to like, I guess it's ultimately just being willing to call out the bullshit and come down with a stance where traditional outlets are not able to speak as freely or are don't have the guts in this moment.
So how much of that is like, let's just take this column, this gaslighting column, and let's just move it to, I don't know, GQ, and it's by Lawrence Duca. Okay, so let's do that. Is it that point? How radical does it look compared with other opinion reportage?
I think that it wouldn't have blown up if it was in GQ. I think that a lot of, like, that was definitely a magic ingredient, is that it came from Teen Vogue, and it's part of the nation kind of reconciling this young women being invested in politics. But
deep political wisdom from a fashion magazine. That's the story. Is that what's going on here?
And I think reconceptualizing the way that young people in general are alienated from politics. I'm working on a bigger project on this now as well, but I mean, the extent to which there's just no, like, the way that politics are taught at even just like a high school level, the way civics are taught, it's very much like, you know, there's three branches of government and there it is, it's done, we did it, democracy, the end. And it's certainly not taught as an active process that requires constant vigilance. And what is the average citizen's role in democracy is not being taught at a young level. I think that there's such a big remove. And then obviously that's compounded by gender and sexism when it comes to young women.
So for instance, in what you just said there is this kind of under glass quality to say a bill originates, you know, spending bills originate in the House, they go to the Senate, ... But there is a sense in which I think, more broadening out the thing that you do and the thing that you write about, that these things are changing and political journalists don't always capture that big arc of, holy cow, things changed in the last 10 years. How did we get here? Instead, it's a lot of, as you say, inside baseball. I mean, you know, okay, we're going to talk about cost-sharing reduction payments in the Affordable Care Act, and will they continue, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I mean, I just said something that matters a lot to me as someone following issues, but it's got that kind of forbidding quality to it.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it is, it's insider baseball, and it's dispassionate, and there's not a very obvious way in for the average person. I think that also it's great that people are making phone calls. That's wonderful. But what is the long-term reimagining of the politically active life? And especially in the hands of a generation that is incredibly passionate, and perhaps criticized as idealistic or, you know, self-centered or focusing on things online. I mean, the way we write off millennials in general, and I think that putting the tools to begin these conversations back in the hands of the youth is sort of very powerful, important thing that could, you know, collectively will change the shape of the future. If we can take this energy and turn it into something real, you know, and beyond the kind of Twitter hashtag resistance, that's kind of, I think, the greatest hope is coming from young people who now are going to be better adept at talking about politics because of the kind of work that Teen Vogue is doing, but that extends well beyond Teen Vogue.
Guys, one final question on this, bringing some of this together. Now that it's been several months, the famous encounter with Tucker Carlson during the interview with you, how do you think back on what was going on with him and why did he handle it that way? And
So this is the interview in which he kind of sneered at her and he – what did he do? I didn't actually see it.
At the end, he was kind of saying you should go back to writing, right, about – quote unquote Teen Vogue kind of issues.
Yeah, it was shocking, and I think that the absurdity of that moment has since been sort of validating, because as I said, there was this sort of stealthy condescension in the reaction that I was picking up on, but it wasn't quite concrete enough to call it out. And so to see it kind of at that extreme, literally stick to the thigh high boots level has sort of galvanized me, and I think galvanized people who have watched it. I mean, the reactions, the number of times some people have come up to me crying over how familiar that felt. Sorry, to be clear, women cry, like the idea of just being dismissed and told to shut up. The just frequency of that kind of feeling and interaction, to see it on such a large scale. I mean, I think he did me a favor, and I think he did a lot of women a favor, because they were able to see it for what it is, and reject it more fiercely because of that.
And yet, so, I mean, can I ask you what you think? Yet he has this huge, he has become a total power in the media, and he has this big show. I don't even know what time it's on now, but I heard it was on at a better time.
Didn't he replace O'Reilly, or am I missing?
Replacing O'Reilly. How is there, in your mind, so much room in the media for that kind of voice, even after people see something like this? And he's had different variations of this, as have many other hosts on that network. How is there so much space in our news media? And I don't know, just as important in the consumers of the media, for this kind of journalism.
Right. Well, that's, I don't know that I would use the word journalism.
But okay, fair enough.
He does commentary. He does what you do, except he does it on TV.
Well, no, but what I do is journalism, because it's held to a standard of verification. I mean, I'm expressing my opinion in a journalistic context. I'm still holding myself to a standard of truth that he certainly isn't. And I think that the performative debate and the sort of toxic faux drama of infotainment is already harmful enough, right? Like, CNN did its own damage, but whatever is happening at Fox News is just, it's not even not guided by the truth. It's sort of become the anti-truth at this point. I mean, Sean Hannity, I don't know what is going on. He's just doubling down on this Seth Rich.
Sure,
thing.
Yeah.
To excel within that space sort of only makes sense for Tucker Carlson. I mean, who exactly, what was his competition, I guess, for the next news slot? Was it like Pepe the Frog and like a rape threat? I think were his competitors.
Maybe what you need is a bow tie. I want to explore the continuum between Fox News and Donald Trump and where we've gotten to. So it strikes me that there's a longer story arc here of factual information becoming less important and speaking to those who agree with you through various technological means, reaching through the airwaves like Rush Limbaugh does, or reaching to your people of similar mind, whether it be by chat room or what have you. It seems like the speed and specificity of communication are very important in fragmenting American politics. And I see that recently, just today, actually, a thing you fresh posted here says, Lauren Duca sounds off on why pop culture and politics are so intertwined. And it strikes me that these things I just talked about, the technology of communication, seems pretty linked to your column today. So maybe some thoughts about pop culture and politics as per your thing?
Yeah, well, I don't know what you're talking about, but I definitely do feel that.
it posted, okay, I'm talking about the thing you posted today, May 24th. And B, what I'm talking about is that communication has made news move faster and has made it easier to narrow cast to people who agree with you. And it strikes me that that's related to your theme today. I think what I really wanted to do was to hear about your column.
Oh, because I wrote this a million years ago.
Oh, well, it went live today at 8 a.m. Eastern.
I wrote this so long ago, so that's why I did not remember. But okay. You know what? It's obviously can speak to this. I think that, it's funny because I previously, that is the work I was interested in doing, was using pop culture as a conduit for discussing social issues. And, you know, that it wasn't overtly political. It was, breaking things down through the currency that people are experts in. I mean, it's again, it goes back to the idea of accessibility. And I think it's much easier to unpack, you know, issues of feminism or racial justice or LGBTQ ish, the sort of identity politics swirl of things become so weightless and clunky and just distracting when they're talked about in these theoretical terms. But if we can look to, you know, an offensive Miley Cyrus music video and sort of explain like how is she accessorizing with Black culture or et cetera, that sort of work, I think, is a more powerful way to break down the forces that define the world in which we live. And that's sort of what I was doing strictly with pop culture before. And I think that, you know, now, and the column is that I've now been able to remember is also about the way that everyone is sort of having to choose a side in a very public way, and these celebrity figures grappling publicly with this toxic moment that is very much a cultural civil war and, you know, probably has been brewing for much longer than we realized and is coming to an head. So how will these things being sorted out on on the celebrity stage and through celebrity narratives, forcing kind of a larger public to think about politics is, I don't think that it's silly. I think
it cuts both ways though, right? Getting people involved in politics through pop culture broadens the base. But an example of someone who is really brought into politics and who mainly understands it at the level of what comes through his television is Donald Trump, right? He gets his information from Breitbart and Fox News, and so he engages like a regular citizen. So you've painted this picture where it's good to get involved. I guess people should get involved but not become president. Is that the idea here?
Well, I don't know if what you just said makes any sense, but...
No, come on. Like, you just said that it's good for people to engage with serious topics through pop culture, and I said Donald Trump learns what he knows from television. I mean, I don't think it's so crazy, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not typically writing and thinking that I'm writing for the next president, so that's a new thing, I guess. But I mean,
I'm taking these columns at the level at which, I mean, you want people to engage. I'm taking it seriously here.
Well, I mean, Donald Trump is not rigorously informed, so it has to be a
okay. All right.
Okay. He is watching TV to see what he's been doing during the day.
Okay. All right.
I mean, I guess the issue is it is a challenge for all. I mean, for everyone who's a journalist who writes in these realms where you're trying to attract and engage as many people as possible, which I agree with you is absolutely vital. Certainly both of us teach to this younger generation and can see the disengagement, at the same time see the thirst to understand. But how do you do that, I guess, in ways that you don't not dumb down the politics, but explain and deal with the politics in a manner that doesn't give you President Trump, but gives you a certain shallower understanding of what's going on? I mean, it seems that's the challenge for journalists outside the formal networks of the media.
Sure. I mean, I think that there is a level of, it's unfortunate that, I mean, I think that I do that without even trying. I think that has always been, I mean, I'm very interested in cultural analysis, and the way that it's segued into more overt political writing has made sense. But I often feel that I'm policing myself with the standard that I'm holding myself to, with the way I'm even just using my voice on Twitter. I mean, I think that this is such a hard moment, right? And no one knows how to make sense of it. And often people are scared to even talk about it. So to see their feelings affirmed in a writer or any kind of cultural figure who has emerged from this moment, there's a lot of responsibility there, and certainly no one's enforcing the standards. And I mean, I think that that's true in terms of precision of language or, you know, the level of seriousness, the level of significance attached to different stories. I'm very scared by what I've seen, because I'm frequently on panels with famous journalists, and I don't know that I always love their answers at how they're breaking these things down. I think that journalism as a profession really needs to have a come to Jesus moment, where we ask ourselves, what exactly is our role in this age of information? We're not gatekeepers anymore. We need to be verifying, and we need to be, like I said, playing that translator role, giving access, empowering people with information. There is so much information, and a lot of it is fake, and a lot of it is warped. And, you know, it's not just fake news. It's beyond that. It's a cripplingly low media literacy level. So how are journalists living up to the standard that citizens deserve and ultimately serving the public rather than meeting traffic goals? There's a thousand things to say, but I think that there are very few people in this industry with the kind of values that I respect there. And part of the problem is that the role of the journalist is not clearly defined in the American mind, and perhaps even in most newsrooms.
Well, just to make this a little bit more concrete, there's these old voices on panels. You're at the forefront of doing something new or something that seems quite fresh to a lot of people. Are there writers out there, reporters out there who inspire you, who you think are doing something new that's exciting, that's broadening the conversation, bringing more people in, doing some of these new things that you want to see? Who's out there?
Who's, I mean, the people that are out there are doing good things within the lanes that they're already in, right? But like Jake Tapper has done a great job with the what he has to work with. I mean, you know, there's people doing great work and certainly more ambitious reportage than anything that Teen Vogue does often is more commentary based. Like obviously Maggie Haberman is killing it. Like there's still great people out there. What I'm talking about is not.
Yeah, but more, I mean, like, you know, changing the playing field.
No, I don't think that. No, the problem is that no one's really willing to. And I mean, a concrete example from this panel is someone from NPR was unwilling to identify herself as a feminist because she felt it impeded on her role as a journalist. And I think that's really silly because where does it end, right? Like, is it, am I not allowed to make it public that I like the color blue? I mean, we're all people and, you know, this is textbook elements of journalism. So I'm not really sure where it got lost in the shuffle. But the thing that has to unite us is an objectivity of method. We're all bringing bias to the table. We're all human beings who have lived experiences and different perspectives and filter bubbles. And hearing things like that, that's just one example of the kind of thing where, again, it's the performing neutrality, performing objectivity, and it's a huge hindrance on the cultural conversation, and the public forum is scrambling for how to make sense of this moment, and the media is so easily discounted already that kind of tightening the knots on these sort of cobbled together rules about how to be neutral and objective is troubling.
Do you ever think that reporters might be or journalists might be goaded into going too far in the other direction? I often wonder with the current president if that's a risk, that now seeking to correct what happened in the election or the kinds of coverage you're talking about still continuing, that reporters, you know, get aggressive in the wrong ways or are hard-hitting in the wrong ways. Do you think that might be another risk we face?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to be incredibly careful. We've seen some of that. I mean, the kind of BuzzFeed did a piece where they called it the blue detectives, sort of, mm-hmm. you know, the hunt for conspiracy theories. I think that there is a tribalism to the way these conversations are being had, and the sort of like, you know, the conversation around his tax returns has definitely lost all sense of reality where, you know, I think that it's very likely that like this potential obstruction of justice is going to be more condemning than whatever's in his tax returns. But we're still kind of like with hot breath acting like that's the holy grail. And that's dangerous because, right, like if we keep the way that is emphasized, the significance of his tax returns is often a tricky thing to handle. So it's like that's definitely an area where I think that we're seeing possibly some of that. I mean, it's all happening. All the problems are happening all the time, right? But I think the bigger problem to me seems to be, I mean, I wrote a column about this too, where I called it pulling a Comey in terms of mm-hmm. acting, the folly of acting out of how you will be observed and, you know, reacting to the perception of you, in this case, as the quote unquote liberal media, by overcorrecting for things that will be perceived in that way. I think that that's a more pressing problem than going too hard.
It must be. Do you find it difficult? I've certainly experienced some of this. Practicing journalism in an era of, you know, Twitter and commentary and the ease of responses. I know this has been an issue with some of your pieces that you get from everyone unfiltered, which obviously can be quite hostile. How have you navigated that world as a journalist?
It's exhausting, mm-hmm. and I have had to pull back from all the feedback just because, you know, there's harassment, and I'm still getting daily death and rape threats, by the way, but there's also just the sort of, like, Messiah-esque feedback where people think I'm going to, you know, like, I'm like the Harry Potter of journalism or something, and that's also stressful because I'm definitely not, and it's just, it's very strange to become public facing, and I have to try to not let it affect my work while also using it in a way to gauge what people need or what they're thinking or what they're feeling. And there are pros and cons. I mean, definitely Twitter as a tool, as a journalistic tool, is valuable and the worst thing ever. So,
But that gets back to the speed of feedback, right? Communication is faster. It's possible to get feedback. At some level, is it good to get feedback? I mean, I will say that I have a fraction of your following on Twitter. And what I do is I just simply don't read things that are said about me at all. And I just don't. I don't read replies to my tweets. I don't read replies. I just ignore all that. Now, I happen not to get rape threats over Twitter. Maybe I do, actually, since I don't read them. I guess I don't know the answer to that.
Have a feeling you don't.
Thank you.
But it does, okay. I mean, it does change the atmosphere of writing. I mean, if you were writing 20, 30 years ago, you got letters, you know, with typegraph letters or whatever coming to your mailbox. But it's different than today.
And, yeah, instant feedback.
And it is part of being a journalist. I mean, you have to operate in this world, not just feedback, but various kinds of nasty and ugly become part of the normal response to what you do.
Yeah. How do you filter out the important feedback from the horrible trolly kind of feedback, though? That seems very hard.
Yeah, I'm amazed by how resilient I've had to be. Certainly no one should have to. And I don't know. I wonder if young writers will be dissuaded from entering this career path because of how exhausting it is. But also that is part of expressing opinions in this climate, with the kind of this intense up and down vote response that you can be hit with as if it's a wave. I mean, I spoke at LSU and I was talking to these students in this one class, and it sounded like they were just actually scared, not even just like putting it out there on social media where it's kind of like curating receipts for your brain, but they were nervous to even bring things up that they were uncertain about. And sort of, how are you supposed to test your worldview about anything if you're too scared to be talking about it? I actually asked them, I was like, so you're just trapped in your own head, forming your opinions without any kind of way to shake it out and make sure it all sticks and test anything? And they were like, yeah, obviously. And I think that it was chilling. And I, you know, that plays into just the average person expressing an opinion. And it's so vulnerable to be a journalist right now to the, it's not even just, oh, I'm tired because people said mean things to me. And like, people saying mean things to me hurts my feelings. I'm not too cool to say that, but it's also people are trying to take me down constantly. You know, I had a tweet over the weekend. It was like not the most brilliant thing I've ever tweeted, but these conservative men were sort of rallying to contact the Today Show because they were doing a segment on Teen Vogue, and they were sort of acting as if I implied I wanted to kill the president because of it. And they included it. The Today Show included it, because they're a bunch of freaking cowards too, in the segment. And it was just, it's so insane that there are people that are actually contributing their energy to trying to take me down in some way, publicly shame me in a coordinated effort. I don't know a lot of people who understand how I'm weathering that, and frankly, some days I'm not entirely sure myself.
I mean, it seems that maybe the thing that can change here is that as more voices come on the scene, getting back to my question for you about who you see out there that's doing interesting work, that adding those voices makes it more normal for a wide range of voices to be expressing opinions. And I think that, you know, it's tough to be first, but the advantage is that you lead the way for others.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's too. It's part of the reason there's a lot of like cult figures coming out of this moment, where you see like a lot of like quote unquote like resistance celebrities, is because there is very little affirmation of these kind of things that people are thinking about and feeling and are afraid to say out loud. So there's a lot of risk in being the one to state them. But I think that's why it's resonating so much. And like, also to tie it back to the pop culture being intertwined with politics, there is something really troubling about the way the cult of personality runs through our politics as well. And I mean, the way that affects even people I have following me. I'm holding myself to a certain standard, but certainly not everyone who is in this position is doing the same. And there's certainly people who are able to be taken advantage of because that media literacy is so low. So it's a really tricky, dangerous, vulnerable, terrible time is, I guess, the answer to that.
You said at your commencement speech, you have this, I don't remember the exact line, even after you didn't know, after all your success and after making it big that you still wake up and you're you, and you will have some of the same concerns and fears that you did before your success. But I think Sam and I both agree that your column really is fantastic, and you've accomplished a great deal, really, in a short period of time with this presidency in terms of covering the politics. And we have to, unfortunately, wrap up the episode. So we want to thank Lauren Duca, who has this column called Thigh High Politics at Teen Vogue and is just writing a number of interesting pieces these days. We urge everyone to take a read. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren.
Thank you, guys. This was great.
And thanks, everyone else, for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Thank you.